What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we are bringing you a special bonus episode of the podcast with one of our favorite writers of all time, talking about one of our favorite current books. Ladies and gentlemen, Kieran Gillen.
I almost saluted, and of course, the salute is no use in a podcast. So
you just hear the respect of the finger to forehead.
We appreciate the gesture.
Yeah. We Foley in some stuff afterwards, so we would have added like a whoosh or something.
Whip crack.
Yes. Very excited to chat about Once and Future. We have talked about every issue of the book. I know Pete is going to have a million questions about one character in particular, but before we get to it, just hold it in for a second, Pete. The big thing that we've discussed about it, and we're fans of all your work, this feels very different in a good way. It feels almost like the big budget Hollywood over the top action, still working in those story elements and those mythic elements that you like to hit. But I'm curious to hear from you. What was the initial germ? What was the genesis? What were you trying to do differently as a writer with this book?
It's always interesting because like most things, I just sort of see the multiple origins of it. I guess it's like, and I've said this before in interviews, but like the core idea I've had for must be like at least of the mid-noughties, because I just had the idea of like, how can you do a sort of Indiana Jonesy mummy-esque story and sort of bleed the colonialism from it? And the idea is, you just do it like, because immediately it was like, it's a bit weird just going back and shooting the founding people of the founding rulers of another people. It's just something increasingly odd about that. And I thought, I know what you do it. You do it in the UK, you do it with King Arthur. And you'd have everything I love about that genre, but like you can have it in a different sort of conversation. And of course, as soon as I have that idea, it becomes, oh, this is about the matter of Britain. This is about like, what on earth is this stupid country of mine? so like all that was sort of sitting there, and the idea came up because, Boom, just to be honest, mailed me and said, Dan would be interested in working with you. Like, have you got any interest to do like a book with him? And it's just involved me. Okay. What am I interested in doing? And I saw, most people have got a load of stuff in the files. And I hit this, this makes sense. Because is Dan interested in doing an action horror book? Because it's also like, the thing about comics is, it's a little bit between having a leading actor or a little bit like a musician. And that kind of, or a singer is a better way of putting it. So like, let's say I found myself having to work with a Bjork. I'm going to work with Bjork. And I'd be looking through my material to think, okay, what would work with Bjork? And the same with Dan. Dan is just like, he is one of the greatest action storytellers. And of course, every issue is better and better as well. I mean, it's weird. Yeah. Everyone always says this, but in this case, it's like, with Dan, I just feel like I'm watching a talent who's always the astounding blossom with every single page. So it's like, okay, he's a completely full-on monstrous action storyteller. He does really charismatic characters. Like all my friends who fancy men, let's say, all of them say that Dan does the best beefcake. So it's okay. I need attractive men. There's definitely that kind of, and then I was like, okay, yeah. Also Dan, then of course I just asked him, Dan, what are you interested in doing you haven't done? And that of course was hot, and that was actually horror. So it's like, okay, great. So that's the tone of the book, sort of I want, Dan is a great full-on action storyteller. Let's do a full-on action storyteller book. And plus, like the first time you can see me sort of step back from my vertigo-ness occasionally. Like there's some storytelling choices which work fine because, Dan can do anything. But I was aware that I want, by leaning into his instincts and powers, you get better results than leaning against them. So that's the aesthetics of it. And the why. And I must admit, like when the idea sort of came back in my files when I was looking at Dan, it was, oh, right, yeah, this is the story that would have worked at any point in the last 1500 years in Britain, because the nature of the question of like, the question of what is Britain anyway has always been there. But with the Brexitiness of it all, it becomes a little bit even more pointed. Does that answer the question? It might answer several questions.
I have a follow up. When in a book like Die, say, it feels like it's about expanding the universe. Every issue, it's like, well, did you know about this place and all the aesthetics of that? But with Once in Future, it feels like it's getting sharper and more focused on. It's like moving in two different directions between those two books. Is that an intentional choice when you're putting them together?
There's only like I am. There's only a limited amount of work in the world you can do. There's also that. Two books I was doing at once. It's like I could not have done four books like Phonogram a month. This is always the thing. Like even if I had the energy, it's like emotionally I haven't got it. So I, when I'm doing my books, I'm sort of trying to create like a stable of books in this kind of like, funny. Like if it scratches this scratches that. And where Once a Future is different is the first time I can think of where I've tried to do what I tend to do in my work for hire books, but owning it. You know what I mean? And then, like, in some ways, Once a Future is closer to my Marvel work than it is to, say, Die. In that, you know, yes, there's quite a lot of research into Once a Future, but it's not like as much as Die. You know, Die's like at least 50. I've lost count of the number of books I've read to write Die. I'm not even including RPG source books in there. Once a Future is a much smaller body. I mean, I say it's still significant, but it's not the level of, okay, this panel is referencing this one thing. You know what I mean? So, like, I'm scratching that. So yeah, it was definitely that in that period I wasn't doing any work for hire, you know, like for Marvel or anyone else. So the idea of, okay, let's do something that's actually fun. And that's the thing, I'm kind of guilty. It wasn't like, especially when it won the Eisner nomination. It's like being nominated for an Eisner for something fun. That's not fair. I should be.
Speaking of fun, my favorite character is the grandma. You have helped create one of the top grandmas of all time. Like, for me as a little kid, this is kind of how I saw my grandma. Like, she was this magical woman who could do anything, and it was like just like another day to her. Can you talk a little bit about this character?
It's like, this is actually the flip, because obviously I mentioned earlier the core idea was, okay, Arthur as mummy villain. And the one thing that idea doesn't include is, who is the adventuress? And I didn't just want to make a, you know, throw in a standard adventure. That doesn't necessarily interest me. So it's, okay, what emotional relationships do I not see in that kind of fiction very much? And also, what emotional relationships in my own life have I not written? So like, and I immediately went to my gran, in that, as you said, it's like, my gran lived around the corner from me. Was the gran I saw most of. And she was, and I found that dynamic between Duncan and Bridget is a little bit like me. And trust, I'm not as goofy as Duncan, and she's not as hard ass as Bridget. But, you know, she came over from Ireland when she was 14. She was like, she's working, she was arrested as a suspected terrorist and all that kind of stuff. Whoa. You know, and I think the first kid in my extended like Irish Catholic family to go to university, you know? So that kind of class, like despite both being working class, that kind of like where we came from in different parts of our lives, I thought, okay, that's interesting. I have not put that in a character yet. And especially because, you know, the stuff families don't talk about is also interesting. You know, so the second I had that, okay, grandmother, grandson, you don't see enough of that. You don't see enough about grandparent, grandchild. In fact, you more like to see grandmother, granddaughter. But, you know, that kind of cross-generational, but also cross-gender.
Yeah.
Like, that seemed like, okay, there's something there. You know, especially because Duncan is in many ways the damsel, for at least for a lot of
it. Yeah. Sure. So that makes me ask, is there like a second cousin, great-uncle story you're working on? Are you shrinking up the dynamics?
It's like, honestly, like, it's a bit like, you just think about, like, what haven't you seen? And there's a bit like, for me, it's always like, what's interesting? Especially because I'm somebody who always tries to ground relationships at least distantly and stuff from my own life, you know, that kind of like, this reminds me of this, but then you twist it. I always remember like when I was learning to write comics, it's like Mark Waid talking about like, obviously I've never fought Doctor Doom, but I know what it's like to stand up to a bully in a playground, you know. And that that was a line that always sort of stuck with me, because it's that kind of stuff is the way you translate stuff, because it's never one for one, but you can find a tiny core of that emotion and bring it to the work. And that's kind of the extended the Duncan. I mean, like, my mum, actually, spoilers for Once a Future, but the my family is nowhere, not like that family, and I am not being trained as a monster hunter.
But, we'll see.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about Duncan as a damsel, because you do have that first arc, which, like you were touching on, is very much the training arc, where he's learning with his grandmother, we're setting up the world, like Justin was talking about, with King Arthur and Camelot and other members of the court. Is the second arc, for those who haven't read it, but it's starting to get into Beowulf and Grendel and other aspects of British myths, I guess you could put it that way. Is it more difficult when you have the character has already technically been trained and you're heading into that second arc, or does that free you up in a certain way?
Well, I think Once a Future, I'm very fond of the first arc, but in terms of it's a little bit tightly compressed for me. As in, it is, in some ways, I've become, Once the Future's become more fluid to write after we've done the setter. Because it's like, this is, I must say, I've got Once the Future sort of plans for like issue 30, you know, and then I've got a few ideas where it could go from there. But at the same time, it's not like Die or Wickediff in that both of those stories always had an end, or Uber. In fact, most of my work has the hard ending.
Right.
And that's when those characters are done. We do not write them anymore. I mean, Die's a little bit different because I've got ideas for sequels to Die, but at the same time, that story is a closed block. Once the Future is like the game designer and writer Robin D. Laws describes as iconic characters. He's got the idea then the dramatic characters, and dramatic characters are about like Hamlet or Macbeth. They are characters who tell a story, have an arc, and end. Mm-hmm. And I've tended to write dramatic characters even when I'm writing the other side, which are iconic characters. Iconic characters like Sherlock Holmes or Batman. As in, we don't come in to really see them change. We come to see them do their thing.
Yeah.
As a Batman adventure is a chance for Batman to express the core Batmanness. And in case of like Bridget and Duncan, I think they are closer to iconic characters than dramatic characters. Like, I've got a really, you know, the dramatic arc is something I really like. But like, abstractly, you can plug those characters into adventures indefinitely. In like, the Hellboy, there's a lot of Hellboy DNA in Once in the Future.
It feels very much that thing of characters being like, oh, here we go again. And there's just another thing to reload the mechanism with these guys.
I mean, exactly. I mean, like, you could, I mean, it's very out of fashion at the moment, but you could do absolutely Once in the Future as a Monster of the Week TV show, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And of course, that's not how I write it. And immediately you've got this, I'll just say, it's not as big as Die, which is perpetually getting bigger, but like, it's a significant universe. And like, we've sort of, there's a wonderful bit that Dan does in, issue 13, where we basically do three panels and each one is an adventure you haven't seen. So like, you know, you get that kind of like, okay, here's the bit they did this. You're not going to see it except for this panel, which I love. You know what I mean? Like, I love doing that to make the universe bigger, but only in that way that making the shadows more interesting. Like, you know, there's always more stuff going on, but you know, we're focusing on this bit.
Well, I'm glad you worded it that way, because I was worried you're going to be like, I like messing with you, the reader, being like, ha, you don't know about this.
Well, there's a lot of big, I mean, like, Once in the Future, like the fact we did the big twists in, you know, there's a variety of twists in the first arc. There's certainly stuff which you don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the kind of like, I was saying this online recently. I was discussing one of the problems of mysteries in comics is, in fact, mysteries full stop in all media is, you have to remind the reader that you not knowing something isn't a plot hole. But it's, as in, it's like deliberately, the fact that, for example, we haven't said, there's Galahad. Galahad that implies there's a Lancelot, because now Nemu, then Elaine would have had to have sex with a Lancelot to begat a Galahad. So who's the Lancelot? And we haven't mentioned that for like a long time, but like, I've got to remind people that exists to make sure they remember that's still a mystery. You know what I mean? So there's definitely stuff to reveal, and there's some really fun, hopefully satisfying bits, because I said, you know, the structure going towards issue 30, but it is less the crazy guy with a load of lines on the wall as well.
Well, there's, I think you touched on this a little bit already, but there's something very different about the mythology of Camelot versus Beowulf and Grendel, just because Beowulf and Grendel is so much more compact. Again, was that sort of freeing in the second arc to be like, great, I just need to write these two monstrous characters, have these big action sequences, and then I can get back to that more complex Camelot mythology?
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Like, what I think the Beowulf, despite being really compressed, like you say, Beowulf is a text, you know, it's a book, as opposed to Arthur, which is a sprawling mythos. And of course, what freeing Beowulf is, it both widens the story in terms of like, oh yeah, okay, we mentioned vampires in the first issue. We've mentioned a couple of other things, but here's something a bit more significant. And what does that imply? As in, who else could they be fighting? As in, if Beowulf's out there, who else is out there? But also the idea of like, how do Arthur and Beowulf differ? And of course, as you've said, I've just said as well, there's only one Beowulf story that we, you know. And of course, in our universe, okay, what does that mean? Where does that go? So as well as being able to throw, you know, Grendel and Beowulf at them, we also get the kind of, okay, so why is there only one Beowulf story? And that's like, obviously only issue 10 has come out, and that's sort of inching closer to explanation. But like, just by reducing it, it also expands it at the same time in a way that I hope people find compelling, because it's, I'm aware I have a tendency of a writer for things to explode indefinitely. because I quite like, you know, making stuff up is fun. And it always has a structure, but the structure can occasionally become overwhelming. And like, Once and Future just feel more like the pop song. I mean, I sort of said this when I was doing Once and Future, like, actually the first question, one of the ideas was, okay, let's just go, let's assume that I've already made the argument that Wycliffe meant, said, as a Wiccan divine basically said something about stories and the nature of stories and how they deceive us. Let's assume that from the first issue that everyone knows this. And so Once and Future is a universe where stories are just bad. As it's 100% parasites who want to kill us. And that, you know, and that's like, and that, you know, having that up front allows me to be a bit more clearer about it. Like, all stories are bad. Every single one you meet is going to try to kill you in this universe. You know, and that's quite, and it's quite compelling because it means that, because I see you often say fans saying, does this mean that like Morgana is going to be good? It's like, no, she's also bad. She's a story. They're all bad.
It's interesting to hear you say that. And I'm definitely on your side here, but we've had this argument on almost every issue. And Pete, I'm going to throw you under the bus here, but I feel like you're the one that's argued like, well, maybe King Arthur isn't that bad. Is there any point, Kieran, that you're like, I kind of agree with his argument, whatever that is.
I think, like, especially now we've got Merlin in, you know, the implicit tragedy of almost any panel when Merlin and Arthur are in, like, Merlin clearly knows more than Arthur does, and Merlin's heartbroken over it, despite the fact they're clearly villains. That's like, you know, talking about mysteries, it's like, okay, something's going on there, and clearly I'm going to tell you about it eventually. So, like, there's something, just because I think stories want to kill you, I don't think individual stories are bad. It's worth stressing, this is just Once and Future. I said it's very clearly. That's the game, you know. My wife, in the last year, couple of years, my wife got into improv. And, of course, improv, people talk about the concept of game. The idea that the game
is...
This is our
language. Yeah. This is our lane right here.
And, of course, in the case of, like, Once and Future, the game is stories are evil. And we're going to play with that game. And, of course, like, I don't believe in stories of dialogue. I don't believe stories are evil. So my story isn't going to say that eventually, completely. But the push and pull between it is where it's interesting.
I think that's so interesting because it's like stories are evil, but you can't kill them. They have to play out or they have to finish, and you have to find a way to complete it where it doesn't kill you.
And in this case, stories make you powerful. You know, like, there's a bit in issue 13. This is very minor spoilers, but it's like Duncan gets beaten up by people who aren't, and it's like, yeah, he's good at fighting stories. That's what the story lets you do.
So at this point, this is open-ended, is what you're saying. You're not, you don't have a plan for like 30 issues, 50 issues. Potentially, it could go on forever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very exciting.
That when I said the iconic, like, an iconic characters, these are pretty much the first characters I've invented, which I, you know, own. I can imagine if it's someone else writing. It's like, in the same way, like, you know, someone else wrote, I could imagine passing on the book to somebody else to write, because, as I said, they're robust enough characters you can plug into mysteries and have fun with. I could imagine that happening. Not that I have any plans for that, but, you know, it is something that I could see happen. You know, I say that, it's like, I would love to just, like, do a mini of, like, people doing one-off Bridget and Duncan stories and, you know, get Becky Cloonan to do an issue and just, you know, tear it up.
Well, there's anyway, a certain sense of when you do something like that, it actually does extend the life of the book, the franchise, versus... certainly it's preferable to have one or two voices, including Dan Mora, in that to focus it. But when you do something like that, it starts to, in the reader's mind, I think, feel a little bigger and take on a life of its own.
Something I say about my Marvel, when I do work for hire for like Marvel or whoever, the characters I've introduced to a world do not feel real in the Marvel universe way until someone else has written them. You know what I mean? Until then, it feels like I'm cheating. You know, like, and almost all my characters, when they like Aphra or even like really very small, like very minor characters, the second they've been written by someone else, they feel part of the Marvel firmament. So I completely get that. I mean, I say this, I have no plans to pass it on. I'm just very aware that it could happen in an abstract sense.
Yeah,
and it's funny. It's like I said, I've got strong plans up to 30, and then it's like I've got other big bad sort of areas I would like to touch in mythology. You know, and that's the question, how long does that go for if I wanted to? Or, like, do you stop and then come back? And, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's unusual for me because all my stuff is like, I came to comics because I like stuff with set endings. Like, the stuff I got into comics through is the stuff that ends. And in some ways, even like as a business thing, comics, the idea that comics have to be unending is not something I necessarily like. I think comics are probably healthier if we turned over the franchises involved in it more often. But at the same time, I can't deny there's something really fun about them as well.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, before we let you go and we'll come back to What's in Future for a second, I'd be remiss not to ask about Eternals. You are going back to Marvel. You are doing that. That's the opposite of a finite story right there in the title. What drew you to that? What is your take on Eternals?
It's one of those things like, I've had a few years off working for, literally it's going to be 5 years, almost the month since I stopped working for the Marvel Universe. When I come back, like, obviously I did a load of Star Wars work, but I had, exhausted my thought processes, I think. And like, I was burnt out and I wanted a gap. And I did a mini last year, with Casper, Wingard, the Peter Cannon mini, which was me sort of dabbling about whether I've got anything else to say about superheroes. So, they approached me and said, are you interested in Eternals? I'm immediately was sort of sitting back and thinking about that in terms of like, actually, this is one of the things which, like, especially talking to, anyone's listening who's like a hardcore superhero fan, they're quite surprised by people thinking like this. But I explicitly do not think about a character until I'm asked to have any ideas for them, because me thinking about something I cannot write is like it's just a waste of my energies in terms of like my thought patterns, and you can't help it. Obviously I do it all the time, but at the same time I don't. So immediately would sit back and it was like, okay, have I any ideas about Eternals? And like, especially to think about like what I want to do. I mean, like, as a concept, and of course this normally was, I go back and read a bunch. So like, you know, I go back and read the original Kirby Eternals. I read, I sort of trace through the path of them through the Marvel Universe. Specifically, you look at the more recent stuff like John Romita and Gaiman's arc, and just think about what is interesting about Eternals, and also what are the problems of Eternals? As in why, you know, where, how can they have a home? Because this is one of the things me and Jamie talk about when we talk about our own books, we talk about this quite regularly, is the... like, you can't introduce a character into the DC universe who is the paragon, all that's good, and everybody loves them, and the most powerful person, because that job is taken. And we joke, it's like we use the baby boomer metaphor. Like, most jobs are taken, and they're never going to retire. So, like, if you're just in DC, you're looking for, like, ecosystems and places where a new character can live. And they do a task that no one else is presently doing. And in the question of Eternals, it's like, okay, let's do that job. Like, what job can Eternals do which no one else is doing, which is different in other ways? And in terms of, like, what attracts me to that, it's always the... I'm going to put a little hat over here for a second and think on the personal level is always something I haven't done before. Like, I've done a lot of work for hire, but, like, something I've not done before. And something I haven't done before is take a book, reinvent it from the ground up, take this classic, renovate it, and then let it go. And also, and then it ties into like a movie as well. That's also interesting. The idea, this is a big, clean, standalone book to try to explain to everyone why you should be into this. And that's something, as I said, Darth Vader is was the sister book to a bigger book. So I've done a lot of being supporting actor, but I've done very few bits where I've got to completely and utterly renovate something. So that's appealing. And especially with Eternals is something which has so much good stuff in it, but it's never been as big as other books. And trying to work out why it hasn't, and trying to do small, respectful tweaks that kind of drill into why anyone cares about this is 100% like it. So that was the kind of thing. So I've done this. I don't know. It's not the full Hickman, is that why?
Great new comic book.
Honestly, like. Me and Jonathan, Jonathan's a guy who came in at the same time as me. So I quite often think about my work being in conversation with his. And of course, I feel that way about, like, me and Fraction are similar. And Kelly Sue and actually Rick as well to some degree. And so Eternals is, for me, it feels like the first post House of X, Powers of X book, you know?
Yeah.
And that,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's definitely more because it's not going to spin out to a million other books. But the idea of, okay, we're going to give you by page four, and the spread on page four and five, we realize, oh, this is a significant amount of thought has gone into this book. Like you said earlier about my mythologies tend to sprawl out. It's like, oh yeah, it's all going to be there on that page. You'll realize, oh my God, Kieran's D&D campaign has come to kill me.
I just want to say I'm very excited to read that. Just talking with you has made me even more excited, which I didn't know I could do. But I wanted to bring it back to Once in Future for a moment and just say that, like, it has been such an honor and so much fun to read and to see you having so much fun with it. But as, like, the fan a little bit, what for you was the most fun part of working on this book? Like, seeing some of the designs, just with the things came together. What for you was, like, your favorite part of it so far?
It's the jamming a bit. It's like, it's almost the opposite of something like Die or even Eternals, as in that, I mean, that's all about the graphs and the elegance and the this is like the jamming in terms of like, okay, I've got an action sequence. I've got 12 pages for this action sequence, which is a long, what I'm going to give Dan enough space to tear it apart. Let's do a full on action. Okay. How, and putting problems to the cat. Okay. We're going to have Beowulf on top of this car. I don't know how they're going to get Beowulf off that car. You know, it's deliberate, like I've left spaces to play. And the same way, like, and it's response to Dan, I see the art, and it's very comics, with capital L comics, rather than literature. Like, I'm always writing with a literary mindset, but like, the fact that I am creating spaces where that we can all have fun. In this kind of, like, if I see something Dan or Tamara has done, I'll respond to it. And yeah, just so much of my favourite stuff is just because they are such delightful characters. I mean, so like, when I made, I thought, okay, maybe I'll write my gram, or like someone inspired by my gram. And I had that line in issue one is, you used to hunt vampires. Yeah. What happened? I ran out of vampires. I just wrote down that literally, like, that was the first thing I wrote for the character. And I immediately saw it in a bigger circle around it in terms of that's the character. Yes. And like, Bridget is such a strong voice. You can get to, like, you just put her in a situation, she'll say something. And that's the kind of, that's what you, I mean, all my favorite characters to write are people who have things to say. Like Bridget, how to phrase, she both, the stuff I agree with Bridget on and the stuff I disagree on, and that's the fun of it. Like the stuff I would never say because she goes too far, and there's also like the stuff I would never say because she's wrong, and the stuff I would always want to say but I can never be that cool. That's the, like, on the writing side, that is the, you know, there's it's ne- but also the other side, the fact that it's a bit freer is I can write the character responses really honestly, and this is always a delight when you just look at the situation and realize, oh, they would do that. And then you write the scene, and since you've kept it a bit looser, you can write it. Like there's a scene in I've just handed it issue 15. You know the characters and the bit where you go, oh right, of course they would do that, and you've got to work out how to stop it. Or like the interaction, that's and the fact that it feels slightly delightful of improvisation out of control. I've said earlier the game of it, as in it's a game for me as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to hear you talk about all this because it feels like, and you mentioned this as well a little bit, but there's definitely a connection between all these things. It's you reevaluating mythology, whether it's reevaluating UK mythology or over it in Turtles. I imagine at least a part of it is reevaluating the mythology of the Marvel Universe because they've been alive the entire time. What is it about that that's appealing to you?
I mean, like, I'm pretty obsessed with death. Like, it's one of these things like, it's like change, and like change is very important to me. And like that was actually that was the thing I immediately got with the Eternals. Eternals does not mean living forever. Eternal means unchanging.
Yeah.
And that, and there's something like, as somebody who leans existentialist by philosophy, like the concept of like being capable of change petrifies me. Imagine, like, are we all now what we're going to be forever? As in other words, is there no redemption? Is there like is there no possibility? So is the world just doomed? You know, because if it's impossible, if change is genuinely impossible, as it is for the Eternals, so that was the thing about the Eternals. Or the you can really dig into that existentialist horror, the idea of being forced, and at the same time they're absolute hero figures, but at the same time they are completely actually not true. Not all of them are hero figures, as you will very rapidly see.
But
that's real. Like it's funny because. Writing about living, people only live for 2 years, allows you to approach the same sort of themes you do approach when writing about people who live forever. They're in some ways just talking about the same thing, because if you use a fantasy device to heighten a situation, you you bring increased focus and clarity to the actual what you're talking about. As in, the question is, and the question for both those things is, what is the point of life anyway? Like, why are we here? What do we do? And that's and who are we? And all those things are really exciting, especially when they we float back to stories, and stories are, and one of the big points of Wickdiv is be really careful about what stories you choose to believe about yourself, especially if they're stories you want to believe, because they're the ones you are easy to, they're the stuff you fall for, you know. And all the work, and that, I mean, there's a lot about Wickdiv about being a critical reader of the world, and just be aware of your prejudices, be, you know, be careful, because belief is a bit like a, I mean, this is, of course, is taken even further into What's the Future. There's a line Bridget, I think, drops in issue 14 or so, and it's very much like stories like maggots crawling for your brain. And then she's, you know, she goes way, way further into that. Yeah, so all that stuff ties together for me. So I'm not sure I've answered the question. But I might have tried to answer every question in the world ever simultaneously.
You're answering all questions at once. I have one more about, you mentioned Eternals, you feel like you're renovating that. So what are the, if there was a house, what are the bones of the Eternals that you're like, oh, these are the necessary parts, and now I get to change everything else?
Right. Some of it is just reframing it, and it's, I think the big, I mean, there's a couple of things I don't want to talk about yet, just because, like, we'll get to them. Like, there's so much stuff. Like, if I talk about any, it's one of these bits where if I talk about any bit of it, I could just, the fractal, the spare, you could, because I'm deliberately making it bigger than the page. As I'm making a, it's actually a very Morrisonian, sorry, Grant Morrison move. But the world is bigger than the frame. As in, like, you know, there's lots of cool stuff here that we could, if we carry on this book, we can eventually get to this stuff, maybe. But it's nice that it's there. But at the same time, the core of, like, what I think is interesting, like, the way Kirby created it, it was very much riffing on Chariot of the Gods 1970s stuff. The idea that the gods on Earth are actually aliens who we've mistaken. And the slight tension with Eternals always has been, A, it wasn't originally in the Marvel Universe. And the problem being that job of gods on Earth is taken by the gods. And it's quite hard to take this seriously, or it's make them as important as an, okay, you know, someone who was mistaken for four, or you know, actual four, you know. And there's very really good writers have done, like, really interesting ways to sort of square that circle in terms of, like, how gods and god imposters exist at the same time. But it doesn't quite, that's the bit that has trouble gelling in the Marvel Universe, and also means that the Eternals kind of take the job of the gods, and they just can't take that job because four's got that job. So it's like, but if you actually look at the Eternals myth is the Celestials arrived on Earth, created 100 deviants, who are basically devils, is the better way of putting it. And then he created, like, 100 Eternals. And then he left. And then the gods left.
Yeah.
And of course, the weird thing about that idea is that doesn't make the Eternals gods. You know, like, we've already got the gods because the Celestials are the gods. What the Eternals are angels.
Right.
Like, if you think about, like, in terms of the role they are the guardian angels, they are basically the guardian protectors of Earth, eternally facing off against these deviants. Like, oh, they're angels. And that's the kind of, like, that's the emotional place they hang in the world. And I kind of, there's a line I use in the thing, imagine a species of eternal Buffy the Vampire Slayers. Like, imagine Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets Robocop. It's one of these things where
now you're talking.
They are, like, they've got programming, so they have to follow certain rules. Or Asimovian rules, and their rules play out in lots of different ways. And of course, how the rules are interpreted is why you get different Eternals. It's that kind of, like, oh, I'm really going in too deep now. But there's a character, put them to their Satan is the best way of putting it. Like, one of the Eternals, who the mission is to protect the Earth. The best way to protect the Earth is to kill everything else, everyone on it, and then just the Eternals will be fine. Like, we don't need these pesky, genuinely genocide is the way forward for the Eternals. And everyone else went, to be honest, not everyone else. Everyone went, no, let's not do that. And now he's in prison forever in hell. You know, and that, and then various other people have different approaches throughout the centuries. So, but the basic concept is, these are unchanging, eternally living beings who protect Earth, whatever that means. And that's, and anybody who's read the Bible knows angels can really do some messed up stuff if they feel the need to. And that's the niche, I think. That's the core thing. That's the idea. And of course, the deviants aren't all bad guys either. That's the other thing. Like, most of the deviants are more like, I describe like Deviant City of Lemuria, like Fraggle Rock meets Hell. Like most, like most of these are pretty cool people. Just occasionally one of them goes off the deep end. And that's where the problem hits.
Yeah. I'm excited for the deviants to eat a lot of radishes. I think I know the answer to this one, but I only ask because I'm sure it's going to be top of mind for a lot of people. What, if any, is the coordination between the Eternals and the movie? Like, should people go in expecting to read Angelina Jolie and Kumail Nanjiani, or is it very much its own two trains running?
It's always like the comics, always their own thing. Like, we definitely make it easier to, we want people to cross over. Fairly, you know, that'd be rude. Imagine it, how rude it would be to say no. But like, it's always got to be, it's like, I don't, it's not something I really talk about much, but like, whilst of course there is synergy between the two, the line we always get told when we're writing is, you're not writing the present movie, you're writing the movie four movies down the road. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you're that's kind of the point of the book, that this has got to be new and exciting. Whilst accessibility is great, it's not, you're not a supplementary piece. You're a piece of the future, I guess.
Right.
Interesting. Before we start to wrap up here, you've already given us plenty of teases, but what is coming up in Once and Future that folks can look forward to, particularly as we start to potentially wrap up this Grendel and Beowulf storyline?
Well, it's like, well, there's the climax of this. The thing about like the second arc, Old English, it's really got that kind of half and half structure. The first half is about Beowulf, and it's the whole, and it's the big adventure of London exploration. And the second half, we made it, I've got the idea just doing the slasher movie around the house, except the house is an old people's home, and the woman is the grandma. And I was just like, let's just really do it straight, do it creepily around the house. We build to the climax, and then, as is my, this is my classic, but like, I, whenever I'm doing an ongoing, it's the end of the arc. The end of the arc is we resolve the story and then everything changes. Like, we have a significant status quo change. Like, the end of last arc was like Merlin's arrival, and that just came out of nowhere. It was got foreshadowed. Well, this is very much like the remaining pieces are thrown up in the air, and like, and there's one big final beat, and you ask, oh, right, that also changes everything. Which is annoying. I don't even want to say the name of the third arc yet, and I've got it. I'm quite happy with it. But that is mainly back to Arthurian stuff. It is Rose is increasingly important in it. It's kind of like, this is what, like, Rose has been like an important like secondary player, but like, I wanted to bring her on stage more, do more about her.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's like, I like her a lot, but like, there just hasn't been enough for her yet. So she's really central. It all happens in a couple of days before New Year's. Like, so in other words, it's end of the year. So we get the kind of the holly and the ivy vibe going on. And we get a little bit more about, Mary / Nimue / Elaine. So we get a bit more about her background as well. Basically there's a lot of those sort of mysteries come back, and there's also the entry into their world of the big problem from the end of the arc. You know what I mean? And it's fun. And it's like, and the end of that arc is the biggest change in the entire run so far. That's the kind of issue 18 into issue 19 would be this apocalyptic change of status quo. Is that there was actually a world where I was just gonna end at issue 18. But now, you know, I'm carrying on, but there was a kind of like, oh yeah, that's an interesting place to end the book.
Ooh, that's a very good tease. Kieran, thank you so much for being here. Loving Once and Future. Very excited to read the rest of it. Thanks so much for spending so much time.
Thank you. It's been amazing to be here.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you. And all of you listening out there, a couple of things to plug. You can support this podcast and other podcasts we do at patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also do a live show every Tuesday at 7 p.m. to Crowdcast and YouTube. Come hang out. We'll almost definitely be chatting about Once and Future pretty much every time it comes out. iTunes, Android, right. Spotify, Stitcher, and the app of your choice to subscribe and listen to the show. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, Comic Book Club out.
Ha ha ha!